Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. This week, I'm joined by Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. Enjoying this lovely warm weather. It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks like we're getting a bit of a summer early, but good.
So this week, we thought we would touch on something that we discussed in episode 47, I believe it was, the episode called Enterprise Storage Is Not Boring, which we recorded with Stephen Foskett. And in that episode, we touched on the idea of quantum computing and how storage might be related to it. Now, as part of that, we said, if anybody was out there who could come on and talk about it, that would be really good. And fortunately, we've been joined this week by Scott Crowder, who's VP and CTO for IBM Q, and obviously at IBM. And he's going to join us and talk to us about quantum computing. Hi, Scott. How are you?
I am great today. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So obviously, I sort of slightly shortened your job title there. So do you want to just give us a bit of background about who you are and what you cover?
Sure. You know, I joke that I have the coolest job in IBM, you know, no pun intended because of the quantum computing part, but I really wear two hats. I'm the CTO for IBM Systems. So across our entire systems portfolio, including storage and servers and infrastructure software. But I'm also responsible for working with research to commercialize quantum computing, our IBM Q program. And that's what I'm here to talk about today.
Wonderful. So obviously, perhaps it would be good to get you back at another point to talk about the storage side of things. But like you just said, we're here this week to talk about quantum computing. Now, from my understanding and my perspective, it seems like an incredibly complex subject. And I guess it has a lot to do with quantum mechanics. But would you mind just setting the scene and giving us some background as to how it works and how it's different to, say, classical computing that people would be used to already today?
Yeah, so it's a completely different type of information science that leverages, as you mentioned, quantum mechanics. So it has certain properties that you can't take advantage of in classical computation. So it's still the early days of quantum computing, but classical computing really didn't start in the 1940s with what we think about as computers. We've been doing classical computing ever since we were counting chickens in caves with our fingers, and we've been able to do pretty impressive things with that just basic leveraging of zero and one binary systems to do classical computation. What quantum computing does is that it leverages quantum mechanics to build off of that and be able to do a couple things that you can't do classically to do very different types of information science. I'll talk a little bit more about those, you know, two majorly different things in a second.
So from my perspective, I would look at, say, classical computing as being very linear in the sense that we execute commands in sequence. I guess quantum computing is using a totally different set of techniques.
Yeah, so one way to think about it is quantum computing leverages some weirdness from quantum mechanics. And the two things that are, you know, hard to get our heads around that are just how the world works, but we don't recognize it in our daily lives, is this thing called superposition and this thing called entanglement. Superposition is basically just a statement that instead of being in a state of zero or a state of one, like in a classical computer, you can be in a state that's a combination of those two states. And that isn't that hard to get your head around. So it can be halfway between zero and one. So when you measure it, 50% of the time it's a zero, 50% of the time it's a one. That is kind of easy to get your head around. But what makes it more complex is that it's actually a complex number state. So it has that little pesky I term or, you know, phase term. So instead of just being halfway between zero and one, you can also be at an angle between zero and one. You can be in an imaginary number. And why does that matter? Why do you care? Is because if you have that imaginary term, the probability of you being in a state can actually be a negative number, which is hard to get your head around. But it's one of the aspects of using quantum mechanics to do information science that allows you to do things in completely different ways. So you can think about it kind of as waves that interfere with each other. So you can basically use quantum mechanics to very creatively come up with algorithms that make the bad answers destructively cancel out and the good answers constructively amplify. And that's just something that you can't do using classical information science.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. But that in its first instance is obviously a very different way of looking at things. It's a very mathematical way of looking at things. And it doesn't really sort of match to what we would think of as classical computing in any way. It's almost like we're inventing a completely new type of computing.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it is a Turing machine in that it, you know, they are universal and can do anything that a classical computer can do, although you wouldn't want to do anything you could do in classically because classical is very good at certain things. But there's certain things that classical computers just suck at. I mean, they're just inherently bad at. There's a whole class of problems that, as you mentioned before, are not linear but exponential. So the complexity of the problem goes exponentially with the number of terms. And it's those types of problems that quantum computing, which you're leveraging superposition and entanglement for can possibly solve those kind of problems that classical computers just never will be able to. It's not a question of, you know, if the classical computer just gets big enough, it'll be able to solve it. There's really a whole class of problems out there that classical computers, no matter how big they ever get, just inherently will never be able to solve.
Scott, can you give us some examples of those problems? Because I'm not sure that our listeners will be able to think of problems where classical computing doesn't fit.
Yeah, so the, you know, the easiest one to understand, we usually don't start with it because we don't want to freak people out, but the easiest one to understand is factoring. So if you give, even when I grew up in the 70s, right? So, you know, a 70s calculator, two large numbers, multiply them together, that's easy for a classical computer to do. But going the other direction, give you a very large number and say, you know, what are the two largest prime numbers you need to multiply together to get that number, is actually a very hard problem for classical computers to solve. And that's why it's the basis for a lot of our crypto standards. Because in one direction it's easy, in the other direction it's really hard. And it's really hard because it's an exponential problem. As the numbers get bigger, it doesn't get linearly harder or more complex to calculate the factors. It gets exponentially harder. And when you start looking around, you find lots of other problems that fit that same category. Quantum chemistry fits that same category. A lot of optimization problems fit that same category, like traveling salesmen, for example. So there are a lot of problems out there that we come up with approximate ways to try to solve, but classical computers really don't do a great job of solving them.
Yeah, you highlighted probably the most important piece there, I guess, and it's that exponential side of things that causes a problem. I think I watched a video online, possibly an IBM video or something similar, that was talking about the idea of when you look at modeling two molecules coming together in an equation, there were 2^64 64 or 60 possible combinations of how the electron shells of the two molecules could actually interact.
Right.
So trying to model what they might do is exponentially impossible to solve on a classical computer. But that apparently is something that would work quite well on quantum computers.
That's right. So, you know, quantum computers leverage this category of entanglement, which is the second thing that makes your head hurt, which is that you can make two particles entangle. So the state of one is dependent or codependent on the state of another one. So they're no longer independent states. And because you can leverage that, the amount of states you can explore in a quantum system do not go up linearly with the number of bits, like in a classical system. They go up exponentially with the number of bits. So if you add one bit to a quantum system, the potential calculation power of that system, the probability space that can explore, goes up by a factor of 2 for every bit that you add. So this is radically different than in classical systems, and is very similar to the problem that you just mentioned in quantum chemistry, because quantum chemistry is inherently a quantum system. So if you add an electron to a molecule, the number of states that you need to compute for in that molecule don't go up linearly, goes up by a factor of 2 for every electron you add.
You mentioned something there, Scott. You talked about bits. Now, I know in classical computing, we would think of zeros and ones as bits. In quantum computing, you have something called a qubit. Could you explain exactly what that means? And what it means to, for instance, have a 2-qubit computer or a 4-qubit computer, and how hard or easy it is to build something of that sort of size.
Sure. So qubits are like the fundamental building blocks of a quantum system, just like bits are kind of the fundamental building block of a, you know, classical storage device or a classical computer. The major difference is that your qubit can be in states that are linear combinations of 0 and 1 in a complex number space, as I mentioned before. And they can entangle with the other qubits in the system so that the state of one can be entangled with the state of the other ones. So that's what makes it very different than a classical bit. So, you know, right now we have 5-qubit and 16-qubit systems online, publicly available that anybody can access through IBM Q Experience. And right now we've got 20-qubit systems that our IBM Q network partners can access. And we announced that, you know, we had, you know, in the labs built a 50-qubit system and are in the process of optimizing that. So, you know, why does that matter, that scale, right? So again, you know, these systems with low enough error rate scale by a factor of 2 every bit you add. So 50 bits seems like a trivially small amount of bits in a system. If you compare it to like petabytes of data, you know, you're talking about much higher order of magnitude number of bits that are in a storage system than the number of qubits that are in a quantum system. But they're exponential. So going from 1-qubit to 50-qubit is not 50-fold increase in the potential state space that you can explore if you had very, you know, no errors. Going from 1-qubit to 50-qubits is a quadrillion times larger state space. And going from 50-qubits to 100-qubits is not a factor of two, it's another factor of a quadrillion. So 100 qubits is, you know, the equivalent state space of a quadrillion times a quadrillion, which is about the same order of magnitude of the number of, you know, atoms on the planet Earth. So it's not like classical computers will ever catch up to that.
Just touching on that, that sounds to me like there must be a potentially theoretical limit past which there's no point having any more qubits in the system, because the ability to do the processing is so good that you can solve any problem, you know, fairly trivially. Does that make sense, or is that me simplifying it too much?
I think it's simplifying it too much. I mean, you're going to have algorithms in quantum just like you have algorithms in classical that you're going to get advantages from having, being able to explore larger state spaces. So you're going to manipulate your information in a completely different way. So it's a completely different way of looking at, you know, scaling your problem. But what it does mean is that when you get to someplace between 50 and 100 qubits, you won't be able to simulate that anymore on a classical system. So you're going to actually need to physically have a quantum system to be able to understand what a quantum system could potentially do for you. You can't simulate it on a classical system and then apply it to a quantum system, which, you know, obviously makes algorithm development tricky, and which is why we're putting such a big push on getting quantum computers in the hands of as many people as possible to get people to understand, you know, this very different information science and what you need to do to be able to use it.
So what does a quantum computer actually look like? Obviously, we're used to seeing a traditional classical computer. We're used to seeing it built on silicon. Is it a similar technology, or how different is it?
So some things are similar and some things are completely different. So when you see it, it looks completely different. It looks like, you know, a giant oil barrel hanging upside down from the ceiling, which is your cryogenics. Because your qubits, you want them to entangle only the way that you want to entangle them. But the entire rest of the universe wants to entangle with them also. So you need to keep it at a very, 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 very low temperature so you have no kinds of noise whatsoever, and it needs to be fairly well isolated. So that's at the very bottom of your cryostat. You're talking about 15 millikelvin in temperature, which is, you know, basically one of the coldest places in the universe, colder than outer space. Out of that cryostat, wires come out. And those wires are attached to things that look a little bit more like what you would used to seeing in a data center. You know, racks of equipment. Those racks of equipment are sending microwave pulses to and from those qubits. And that's the way you program them. You program them with microwave pulses as opposed to zero and one levels. And then you have, you know, classical systems that basically take your Python code and then translate that into those microwave pulse signals that go to your computer, quantum computer, and back.
Wow. Okay. So that's a pretty complex system compared to what we're used to. It's not like this is going to be something that everybody builds. This is a very, very specialist set of equipment. And as you said, it needs a certain specialist amount of technology and skill to program.
Yes, that's right. So, you know, from an operation point of view, the technology is advancing so rapidly that it doesn't really make sense for it to be anywhere than in a cloud environment and, you know, a service delivered at this point. Also because it's very different. Typical data centers don't worry about dilution refrigerators and cryogenic equipment, et cetera, et cetera. But in a lot of ways, it's very similar. The way that you program it is with Python. The way, you know, our software development kit, you know, is in Python, leveraging Jupyter Notebooks, leveraging as much of the classical learnings that we've learned over the last 60, 70 years, and applying it to this new information science. But you do need to have or train yourself in, you know, what the right commands are or instruction sets are for quantum computing as opposed to for classical computing. It doesn't at this point still abstract that away. Over time, people will build library elements that abstract the quantum computing away from, you know, the average app developer, and they'll just, you know, call a routine to do a certain type of algorithm on a quantum coprocessor, and it will be completely transparent to them.
I was going to say, so that's likely to be transparent to the developers. So do we see in the future that when a developer is working, some things may be submitted to a classical computer and some may be submitted to the quantum computer coprocessor, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, the way you should think about it, you know, merging things from different fields is it's a loosely coupled coprocessor right now. So you write your code, some of that code is executed on a classical computer, and then a certain part of the code is executed on your quantum coprocessor. for those parts of the problem that, you know, are very hard for classical computers to do, those exponential parts. And then the rest of it's done classically.
Yeah, so I was thinking it was a very similar architectural model to the way me and Chris have come from a background in mainframe and a long history in this sort of thing. So vector processing in the past was something, a particular thing would be passed off to a vector processor.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of analogies in the classical world of a coprocessor, and it is very similar to that, yes, in a lot of ways. Right now, it's loosely coupled. We envision over time, because of, you know, data constraints, that you might actually put like a quantum processor within the framework of a Z-Systems environment for security, because the data is there, et cetera, et cetera. So over time, it may become more tightly coupled to your classical system. But at this point in the early days, really like a loosely coupled API call that goes to your quantum system. And you can intersperse your classical commands with your quantum commands.
I'd like to just go back one second, if I may, just to some of the earlier stuff we talked about. And you mentioned just a minute ago, Scott, about the idea of microwave programming in order to translate whatever code you've written in Python and pass it up to the computer to execute. But if we go back to the basics of how qubits work, how do we even measure the result of a calculation or an experiment or an execution of code? And the reason I'll ask that question is because one of the things I've seen online is the idea of four playing cards and an algorithm where you, if you were doing it in classic computing and looking for the queen, for example, one out of four cards, you would just turn the cards over, for example, randomly or in order, and that would give you, say, one in every 2.5 goes you find it in classical computing. In quantum, it's one execution. But how do you know you've got the right answer when you've run that? It seems to me that that's like that a really fundamental sort of requirement to understand.
Yeah, so you, in that case, you're using something called Grover's algorithm. It's one of the algorithms that in the past couple decades, you had two classes of people. You had the folks who were coming up with theories, algorithms in theory, working on the back, like Pythagorean theorem for quantum, right? So back of the piece of paper or on a whiteboard, writing down an algorithm and proving mathematically that it has an advantage over a classical algorithm. And one of those is Grover's, and it's basically a way to leverage those interference patterns we were talking about that you can do in quantum to do search more efficiently than you can do classically. So basically, you're encoding the problem, and you can do it in one step as opposed to multiple steps because the quantum system can basically store state information and can leverage those destructive and constructive interference patterns to basically magnify the right answer, in one step or less steps in this particular case than you can, if you had to do it classically. That's kind of the algorithm side of it,
okay,
right? On the execution side of it, the microwave pulses are used to basically set the state of the qubits. And you can think of the state of the qubits being, either being in a ground state or an excited state. And you can think of them as being, rotated. So it's a wave of a certain, amplitude, energy level, you can think of it. But it also that wave, in addition to the energy level, can have a rotation. The qubit can store basically called a rotating wave approximation. And that can actually be measured. And when you measure it, it collapses to either high energy state or low energy state. And that high energy state or low energy state is an analog signal that gets converted back to digital with your control electronics. The tricky thing, which is hard about quantum information science, is this concept that even though when you measure it, it looks probabilistic. So if I put something halfway between 0 and 1, that's actually a definite state. It's definitely, that state is absolutely definite. But when I measure it, half the time it's a 0, half the time it's a 1.
Right.
So the trick of the algorithms are to use all of this potential intermediate state space and entanglement, but then creatively use this algorithm so the end result in a lot of algorithms can be a definitive one or a definitive zero for the actual answer that you're trying to find. And that's what Grover's algorithm does for search, like you just described.
Let's move on and talk about data and the practical applications of the technology. So I think maybe the two will be good to discuss together because we are on a storage podcast, and obviously, therefore, we're looking at we think of storage in a classical way, as you mentioned at the very top of this, about having petabytes of data you might want to analyze. In terms of looking at how it fits into that scenario, exactly how would a quantum computer use data to that degree? Is it that interaction between classic and quantum? And how does that apply apply to, say, a whole range of applications.
Yeah, no, that's great. So the one thing to kind of hint it at with quantum is there's actually a small amount of data in, exploring a huge number of permutations of that data, and then a small number of data out. So it's really not a big data system. It's a big probability space, big possibility space system. For example, you know, you gave the example of a molecule, right? Like caffeine or something that has, like, you know, whatever it needs, like 150 qubits to be able to simulate. But that's 150 bit. It's actually a fairly small amount of data that you're pushing down to your quantum computer, and a fairly small amount of data that's coming out in terms of number of bits. But you've got this exponential going in the middle, where 2 to the 150th is a huge number. So it's a very different paradigm to what we're used to with, you know, big data classical computation. So it's not going to replace the big data kind of storage or big data kind of applications anywhere in the near future. What it's going to do is help solve those problems that are small amount of data, but huge number of possibilities hidden in that data that you're trying to pull an answer out of.
Okay, so this is not going to be number crunching like people might think of, where you've got a huge data set and you're trying to try and find some value into it. This is about, as you just said, theoretical possibilities and combinations and being able to narrow down the amount of actual compute time it takes to solve that sort of a problem.
Right, and you know, again, when you start, you know, peeling the onion on the types of problems that are out there, there are a lot of problems that, you know, the number of variables are in the tens or hundreds or moderate number of hundreds, but they're just computationally impossible to solve on a classical computer, at least directly. You find them in machine learning when you're trying to basically do training and set the weights for a machine learning model. You know, the number of different possibilities you need to explore given the number of variables can blow up on you for things like classification, support vector machine kind of things. It can be quantum chemistry when you're trying to, you know, establish what the energy levels of each of the spin orbitals in your electron, in your molecule are. Again, similar problem where you're talking about hundreds or tens, high tens or hundreds of variables, but calculating them is nearly impossible or quite literally impossible on a classical system. So it's things like that that the quantum coprocessor is going to go after.
So Scott, what impact does quantum computing have on the future of encryption? Because that seems to be the one thing that comes up an awful lot.
Yes. One of the blackboard algorithms that people proved, you know, 20 plus years ago now, was something called Shor's algorithm. And what that proved was that a quantum computer of sufficient size and sufficient low error rate, so it was basically fault tolerant, could do factoring. You know, the give you a very large number, find out the two largest prime numbers that multiply together to get that, much more efficiently than classical could. Which means that when you get to the point where you've got quantum computers of millions of qubits that allow you to do fault tolerant at sufficient scale, then our current crypto standards, which are based on the fact that factoring is very hard, would have problems with those types of quantum computers. So, I mean, the good news is that, well, there's two pieces of good news. The first piece of good news is that that is some distance away. You know, we're right now on order of tens of qubits, not anywhere near on order of millions of qubits. So, you know, it will be counted in decade timescale before we get systems that can most likely be able to, you know, decrypt efficiently. The second bit of good news is that people have been developing quantum resistant crypto standards. And I know in the US, NIST has, you know, put a lot of work into trying to get to a new standard for quantum resistant or quantum state safe crypto standards. And there's things called like lattice cryptography, which uses some, you know, linear algebra tricks in order for you to have a crypto standard that is much, much more quantum resistant. So there are solutions out there, and it will be some time before we get there.
Sounds like you can rest easy then, Martin.
It's for one use case which everybody seems to come up with. Oh, we can use it to decrypt the world's communications in seconds, and cryptography is now broken and we're all doomed. So hopefully we're not doomed for at least another 10 years.
Yeah, sounds like it. That's good.
Yep. So I think we need to, you know, carefully consider it. We need to prepare for it. But us and other industry players are making sure that by the time quantum computing gets there, we will have a standard that allows you to still have quantum resistant.
But it won't matter anyway, because Facebook will know everything about you anyway.
It doesn't protect what you give away unencrypted.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, Scott, we're just coming towards the end of our time. It'd be really interesting for you to just take us through what IBM is using quantum computing for, whether people could go on and try this out for themselves. I think you sort of mentioned that that was theoretically possible. Just give us some background on, you know, exactly what the technology is being used for within IBM today.
Yeah, so you know, we have this IBM Q program, and it has basically three components to it. IBM Q Experience, which is publicly accessible quantum computers. So there's simulators out there for people to use, which is kind of cool. But the more cool thing is that you can actually run on real quantum computers. So no longer, if you're doing quantum theory, do you need to just do it on a blackboard. You can actually, you know, write some code and send it via an API to a, actually we've got three of them live right now, two different 5-qubit systems and a 16-qubit system. The second major thing that we're doing is our Qiskit, which is basically a software development kit that allows people to start writing code in Python, in Jupyter Notebooks, if that's their preferred method, writing quantum algorithm code, playing around with it, learning more, starting to build their skills. And the third thing that we're doing is called the IBM Q Network. And the IBM Q Network is our deeper partnership model, where we're partnering around the world with research institutions and academic institutions to create hubs. So they can be local centers of expertise and work with industry partners in that geography to help them build skills and explore the technology. And we're also working with, you know, directly with industry clients around quantum computing, where we're jointly exploring, you know, how quantum computing can potentially in the future bring business value for the use cases that they care about.
Wonderful. Okay, thanks very much, Scott. That was great. Whereabouts online can people find out about this? What website should they be pointed towards? And you, for instance, do you use Twitter? Can people follow you?
People can follow me on Twitter or on LinkedIn. LinkedIn's probably better for me. In terms of on any search engine, just type in IBM space Q, and there's lots of good material there. There's lots of good videos. There's lots of good education material. There's links to the GitHub repositories with the code and tutorials there. There's also links to the real quantum systems, and there's links to information about IBM Q Network there as well.
Wonderful. Thanks, Scott. So hopefully we can talk again in the future, maybe about something specifically storage related. But thanks for joining us this time. And thanks to everybody for listening. You can catch us online at storageimpact.com, as usual, at Storage Impact on Twitter, or you can do a search for Storage Impact on LinkedIn and find us on the group there, where we'll provide all of the information that we've discussed today and some additional links so you can find that stuff. Okay, that's great. Thanks, guys. Talk to you again soon.